Morning, everyone. How are you guys doing? It's good to be here with you. Like Marge said, I just had my third baby. That's right, 1, 2, 3. It's pretty crazy. He's 2 months old, and he wakes up every 2 hours. And so I thought today it would be a good idea for us to pursue the Lord in dreams and visions. And so we're all going to take a collective nap, all right? What do you guys think? Yeah? No. Okay. We're in a series, we're wrapping up a series called Soulology. It's the study of the soul, and we said everybody has a soul, whether you want to admit it or not. Your soul is eternal. It's the deepest part of you. And for all eternity, it will stand in some relationship to God. And because of this, one of the most important things that you can do is care about your soul. To ask yourself the question, how's my soul doing? Right now, how's my soul doing? And so we've been walking through the weeks talking about the fundamental needs of the soul's need for identity, the soul's need for security, the soul's need for satisfaction, the soul's need for love, the soul's need for rest. And today, we're going to be talking about the soul's need, every human being's need for meaning. For meaning. Now, let me give credit to where credit is due. A lot of the research, I've been greatly benefited and blessed by the incredible thoughts of guys like Alistair Begg, Tim Keller, Ravi Zacharias, Derek Kidner. So I just want to give, I'll just give proper credit to where it's due. Albert Camus, Leo Tolstoy, Aldous Huxley, Voltaire, Shakespeare, Jesus Christ, and yes, even Cosmo Kramer. These great thinkers and philosophers of history all had this in common. They knew that the average person is so busy, so very busy with work and play, that they never stop to ask the question, what's it all for? What's it all for? I mean, why am I doing this? What's the reason for doing everything and anything? All the striving, the studying, the applying, the waking, the working, the resting, the cleaning, the caring, the raising, the shopping, the drinking, the eating, the enjoying, all the stuff that we do, all the stuff that we fill our lives with and occupy our time with, when it's all said and done, the question is, what's the point? What's the reason? What's the reason for life? And these great thinkers knew that most of us run around and we're so busy. I mean, we're so busy, it's crazy. It's crazy. When I started out in youth ministry 15 years ago, that's right, it's been 15 years. And you guys are looking at me like, when did you start? When you were 2? Hey, well, what can I say? I'm moisturized, right? When I started out 15 years ago, I used to be able to say to a kid, hey, you know, you want to go hang out? You want to go watch a movie? You want to go play some ball? You want to do something? And they'd say, yeah, sure. Yeah, let's go do it. Nowadays, it's crazy. We got all these little E-Trade babies running around. And, you know, you have these little 6-year-old kids with iPhones like, hey, you know what, Kev? Yeah, I can fit you in from 3 o'clock to 3:15 on Wednesday. You can fit me in? What? What, you got like an appointment with Mickey Mouse? Seriously, right? And we're all very busy people. We're very important people. We got places to go and people to see. Yet for all the activity and all the running around, what's the reason? Have you thought about that? See, most of us won't ask that question. Most of us don't want to think about that question. And all the great thinkers point out, if you don't think about it, that's the height of absurdity and foolishness. The unexamined life, Socrates says, is a life not worth living. Let me show you what I mean. Suppose I said to you, tomorrow, I want you to go to Dreger's supermarket and stand in the frozen food section from 4 o'clock to 4:15. And if I said that to you, what would you say back to me? Why, right? You'd say, why? That's the correct response. That's the right question to ask. Why? What for? And I said back to you, well, what do you need to know that for? I mean, I asked you, didn't I? And you can do it, can't you? So tomorrow, I want you to go to Dreger's supermarket and stand in the frozen food section from 4 o'clock to 4:15. And you'll say back to me, "Well, I'm sorry. I mean, I like you and all, but I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it unless I know what for, unless I know the reason." And that's right. That's the correct response. That's natural. And the great thinkers and philosophers point out, you will ask that question. You will ask that question about how you're going to spend 15 minutes of your time tomorrow. You want a reason for that. You want justification for that time. And yet, you won't ask that about how you're spending your life. What's your life about? How do you know it's not a waste? Can you justify it? What's the reason for your life? And there's no better place to get wisdom on this than a little book found in the Bible called Ecclesiastes. And anyone who has ever read Ecclesiastes knows that this is one of the happiest and cheeriest books in the Bible. And so just to give you a little happy infusion, I'm going to read to you from Ecclesiastes chapter 1. These are the words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly, completely, totally meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What do people gain from all their labors at which they toil under the sun? Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets and it hurries back to where it rises. The wind blows to the south and it turns to the north. Round and round and round and round it goes, ever returning on its course. All the streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place the streams come from, there they return again. All things are wearisome, tiresome, more than one can say. The eye has never enough of seeing, nor the ear its fill of hearing. What has been will be again, and what has been done will be done again. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? It was here already long ago. It was here before our time. No one remembers the former generations. And even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow them. I, the teacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. I applied my mind to study and to explore by wisdom all that is done under the heavens. What a heavy burden God has laid on mankind. I have seen all things that are done under the sun, and all of them are meaningless, a chasing after the wind. What is crooked cannot be straightened. What is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, look, I have increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled before me in Jerusalem. I've experienced much of wisdom and knowledge. Then I applied myself to the understanding of wisdom and also of madness and folly. And I learned that this too is a chasing after the wind. For with much wisdom comes much sorrow. And the more knowledge, the more grief. Aren't you glad you came to church today? And what did I tell you? Like, warm fuzzies all around, right? Now, before you wonder why you got out of bed to come to the service, let me tell you a little bit about the Kohelet. That's the guy who's speaking in the book of Ecclesiastes. Because if you understand who he is and you understand what he's doing, the book makes a lot more sense of why it's in the Bible. Now, the Old King James version of the Bible. Anybody here still rolling with the Old King James? There we go. We got a couple of people. The Old King James version of the Bible calls the Kohelet the preacher. The preacher. And I think it's a little bit misleading. Some of the newer translations, like the NIV, call the Kohelet the teacher. These are the words of the teacher, and that's a little better. But probably the best descriptor of the Kohelet is the philosopher. The philosopher. And I'll tell you why. He is not a teacher, and he is not a preacher in the sense that he is not trying to give you answers. He's not trying to give you answers. Well, what's he trying to do then? Well, he's a philosopher. He's a philosopher. He is trying to raise questions in you to make you think, to goad you, to provoke you, to discomfort you. See, Ecclesiastes is not a book where you go to find answers. You find answers in the rest of the Bible. The philosopher's job here is to lay out your foundation, to lay bare your assumptions, your core foundations, and to blow it up, to wreck you in a sense. The philosopher is trying to push you and push you and push you to say, why do you believe that? Why do you believe that? Why do you believe that? And if you believe that, don't you see where it leads to? He's trying to push you and push you and push you because he knows that you're too busy, that you're too distracted, that you're too scared to really look and ask the question, why, about everything you do and everything you believe. And he begins with the fundamental question of the ages in verse 3. What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? You're working very hard. You're putting in 80 to 100 hour weeks. You're working very hard. You're working very hard. And what does a person gain from all your hard work at which you toil under the sun? At the end of your life, when all is said and done, what profit? What do you have to show for it? And you see, this question is unavoidable and is inescapable. And it will lead you to the abyss if you don't have good answers for it. And I can guarantee you this, your answer had better be more than I want to be successful and make a lot of money. You see, because Leo Tolstoy, he talks about this in his Confessions that he wrote in 1879. This is towards the end of his life, and at the end of his life, he was really doing quite well for himself. He was really famous. He was highly respected. He was an intellectual. He was highly accomplished. He was influential. He was powerful. He was wealthy. He was in the inner circles of elite society. I mean, these are all Silicon Valley values, are they not? He had it all. Had it all. And then he crashed. He absolutely crashed. He had a meltdown. He went into depression, and he talks about what caused it in his Confessions. He said, the question caused it. The question brought me to the edge of the abyss when I was 50 years old. And the question is this: what will come of what I do today and tomorrow? What will come of my entire life? Or expressed differently, why should I live? Why should I wish for or do anything? Or to put it another way, is there any meaning in life that will not be destroyed by my inevitably approaching death? My deeds, my works, my accomplishments, whatever they may be, will be forgotten sooner or later, and I myself will be no more. Why then do anything? I could not attach a rational meaning to a single act in my entire life. And the only thing that amazed me was how I failed to realize this from the very beginning. How could anyone fail to see this? That's what's amazing. And this, and you get this. He says, it is possible to live as long as life intoxicates us. But once we're sober, we cannot help seeing that it's all a delusion. And there's nothing funny or witty about it at all. It is only cruel and stupid. That's Tolstoy. And you say, well, that's Tolstoy. He's Russian. He's an artist. He's supposed to be gloomy. All right. All right. Well, what's your answer then? What's your answer to that question of life? And that is what the book of Ecclesiastes is pushing you to think about. What's your answer when you stop being so busy? when you stop distracting yourself and intoxicating yourself with work and play, when you stand back and think, when you seriously and deeply reflect, what's your answer to the Kohelet's question, what do you gain from all your labors at which you toil, diligently toil under the sun? What are you living for? What's your life for? What are you hoping to accomplish? What difference are you really making? What's your reason for living? Have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? And like the great philosopher he is, the Kohelet, he anticipates the stock answers that people give, and he completely dismantles them, completely takes them apart. What are the stock answers that people give? There are three. What's the meaning of life? What's the reason for your life? The three stock answers that people give are the answers of the humanist, the hedonist, and the existentialist. The humanist, the hedonist, and the existentialist. The humanist says the meaning of life is to make the world a better place to live. I'm here to make the world a better place to live. That's the humanist. And you've heard that before, right? You've heard that before. The hedonist says, you know what? Yeah, you're right. Life is meaningless. And therefore, the only way to find meaning is to enjoy the little time that we have here on earth and to find meaning in the day in and day out pleasures of life. That's the hedonist. And the existentialist says, there is no meaning, and you just have to come to terms with that. You have to embrace that, and you have to create your own meaning. And those are the three stock answers that the Kohelet says, if you think about them, if you seriously think about them, they're all completely ridiculous. They all fall apart. And so let's think about it. Now, before we begin, let me point out the key to understanding the Kohelet's arguments. The key to understanding the Kohelet's arguments. He says, what gain do you have for all your toil under the sun? Now that phrase, under the sun, is key to his line of thinking. Under the sun is the Kohelet's way of saying, apart from God. He's saying, you know, we're not talking about stuff above the sun. We're not talking about the heavens. We're not talking about God. We're talking about stuff under the sun. So the Kohelet says, let's assume for a moment that nature is all there is. Let's assume for a moment that there is no God, there is no eternity, there is no soul. Let's assume that the only life there is life under the sun. Now, if this is the case, then the three stock answers that people give to what's your reason for living are complete nonsense. Complete nonsense. Let's start with the humanist answer. Humanist says the meaning of life is to make the world a better place, to help others, to make a difference in the world, to make a difference in people's lives, to improve our lives and the lives of the next generation. The Kohelet, the philosopher, says, if there is no God, if life under the sun is all there is, that is utter nonsense. That is utter nonsense, because there's nothing you can do that will make a difference in the grand scheme of things. Nothing. When it comes to human history, your life will not make a difference. In verse 11, he says, there is no remembrance of men of old, and even those who are yet to come will not be remembered by those who follow. And remember, this is exactly what Tolstoy realized. He said, is there any meaning in life that will not be destroyed by my inevitably approaching death? My deeds, whatever they may be, will be forgotten sooner or later, and I myself will be no more. Why then do anything? I mean, sure, go ahead, help people, make the world a better place to live, if it makes you feel better. But let's be clear, the Kohelet says, it won't make one lasting difference, because you will die and be no more, and the people you help will die and they will be no more. And 40 years from now, 400 years from now, 4,000 years from now, 4 million years from now, everything will be forgotten. And not only will everything be forgotten, But if this life is all there is, what difference does it really make what type of life you live? What difference does it really make if this life is all there is? What difference does it really make if you live a life of violence and oppression, or you live a life of sacrifice and compassion? What difference does it make when one day, 3 billion, 4 billion years from now, all of civilization dies? All of organic life on this planet dies. Planets come and go, and the solar system dies. And when it is all gone, when it is all completely gone, and there is nothing, what difference will it make? And that's the point. The Kohelet's saying, in the end, when everything's over, when life as we know it's over, it won't make one iota of a difference whether you lived a life of compassion or violence. Everything in the end will be nothing, and all your work, the work of the humanist, will be meaningless, 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 if life under the sun is all there is. You say, you know, I just want to make the world a better place. That's why I live. And the philosopher says, give me a break. Fine, you're right, you're right, fine, you're right, fine. Like, making me feel bad, fine, you're right. And then what does it really matter? There is no ultimate meaning. There is no ultimate purpose. Therefore, all you can do is enjoy the short time that you have here on earth and find meaning, however fleeting, in the simple pleasures of life. And the Kohelet says, actually, that's a good idea. You should go do that. Go do that. Go ahead and enjoy the simple pleasures of life. Take a walk, write a poem, drink, eat, take vacations. But then he says, but you know what the problem of pleasure is, right? It's a form of madness. It's a form of madness. Because if life under the sun is all there is, if we are indeed what Bertrand Russell calls an accidental collocation of atoms, if we are indeed what Voltaire, he was great. He says, we are tormented atoms in a bed of mud, right? You gotta love Voltaire, right? I mean, great. He's the guy you want to invite to your dinner parties. If that's true, then the only way to enjoy the pleasures of life is to not think, to suppress the truth and keep reality from breaking in. Let me show you what I mean. And C.S. Lewis, he puts it beautifully in one of his essays from his book, Present Concerns. He says this, C.S. Lewis says, let's assume that there's no God, and let's assume that this life is all there is. And you fall in love with the girl, and you really like her. She's the love of your life. And as you embrace her, you realize that there is no such thing as love. And that what you're feeling for her right now is a sort of psychic phosphorescence that's arising from the behavior of your genes. You're listening to a piece of music and it moves you to tears. And then you realize, actually, there's no such thing as beauty. There's no such thing as beauty. This is all an illusion. And the only reason why you like this is because your nervous system is irrationally conditioned to do so. And Lewis says, so you may still, in the lowest, lowest sense, have a good time. But just insofar as it's very good, and just insofar as it threatens to push you out from cold sensuality into real warmth and enjoyment and enthusiasm and joy, to that extent, you will be forced, and this is great, you will be forced to feel the hopeless disharmony between your own emotions and the universe in which you really live. He's saying, the only way I can enjoy music, the only way I can enjoy falling in love is if I continually, continually, continually stop thinking about reality. Because how can I really enjoy love when I know deep in my being that this isn't real, that what I feel for my wife or my kids isn't real? It's just psychic phosphorescence from my genes. And how can I really enjoy music, really enjoy art, when I know I may enjoy it for the moment, but true beauty does not exist? The beauty beyond does not exist. And I'm only moved because of the electrochemical impulses in my brain are telling me to enjoy it. I hold my baby Isaiah, 2-month-old baby, and I love holding him because he's so soft and mushy, right? just like his daddy. I'm just kidding. I hold Isaiah. And then the reality breaks in. He's nothing more than an accidental collocation of atoms. He's just cute dust and ashes. Or Robert Jarvik, the inventor of the artificial heart, he says, you know, we're no more important than rocks or viruses. Or Jacques Monod, the French biologist, he says, we're actually grown-up genes. Oh, I'm holding my kid, and all he is just cute, grown-up germs, right? How can I enjoy pleasures when reality keeps breaking in? It is all an illusion, and it's all meaningless. And so the only way I'm going to enjoy these pleasures is to not think, to be an ostrich and put my head in the sand. And that's why laughter or simple pleasures, the Kohelet says, is madness. But there is a greater madness than laughter, and that is the inherent contradiction of the existentialist philosophy. The third stock answer to the meaning of life is the answer of the existentialist. There is no ultimate meaning, says the existentialist. And you just need to embrace that fact and create your own meaning. Create your own meaning. And that's great. That's perfect. Except no one can live that way. No one can live that way. Because don't you realize, if you embrace the doctrine of meaninglessness, there is no absolute ethic. There is no absolute ethic. If there is no meaning, we create our own meaning, then there is nothing that is absolutely right, and there is nothing that is absolutely wrong. The shooting in Colorado where a lone gunman comes in and he shoots and he kills 12 people, is that absolutely wrong? Is that evil all the time? Is it? Or genocide, is genocide wrong and evil all the time? Is oppression wrong and evil all the time? How can you say? If everyone is entitled to create their own meaning, right and wrong are totally subjective. See, here is the problem of saying, yes, everything is meaningless. Philosophically and intellectually, we say no absolute ethic exists, but we live as if they do. Philosophically and intellectually, we say love and beauty don't exist, but we live as if they do. Philosophically and intellectually, we say human beings are accidents of nature. They are no different than rocks or viruses, but we live as if there's a difference. And it forces us to live with these huge internal contradictions. So then, what does it mean that we are constantly rejecting and denying reality? There was a play on Broadway called Man of La Mancha, Existentialist Manifesto. The whole story is about a man who discovered that the world is cruel and senseless and meaningless, that there are no knights of the round table, there is no nobility, there is no chivalry, there are no transcendent values, there is no right that triumphs over wrong. That's the reality. And so what does he do? He decides that he's going to live as if those things are true anyways. He rejects reality, and he lives as if there's nobility. He lives as if there's transcendent values. He lives as if there's chivalry and ultimate good. He lives as if those things are true. And the debate around the man in the play by all the different characters is he insane? Interesting, isn't it? Interesting. There's a Scottish psychiatrist in Philly in the 60s, a man by the name of Artie Lang. He was an existentialist psychiatrist, which meant that he based his therapy on the existentialist philosophy. And he said, since life and reality was cruel and senseless, if I were going to live a compassionate life, I had to be out of touch with reality. Therefore, by definition, really compassionate human beings were insane. Now, don't just knee-jerk reject what he's saying. Follow the logic. Follow the logic. Yeah, there's no God. There's no God. We're all accidents. We're all moving toward annihilation. Our origin is meaningless. Our destiny is meaningless. But while we're here, let's work for human rights. Let's believe that every human being is valuable. Let's work for equal rights and justice for all, despite the fact that our philosophy says otherwise. And the Kohelet says, really? Really? And that's why even Albert Camus had to admit that to live an authentic life is to live a life of absurdity. Do you see what the Kohelet is doing? He's pushing you and pushing you and pushing you to say, look, you really need to figure this out. You got to figure this out because there is no middle ground. Because some of us here are secularists who say, despite my worldview, I believe in human rights. Despite my worldview, I believe in good and evil. Despite my worldview, I believe in human dignity. You say there is no God, but you're living as if there is. And then there's some of us here who are Christians, and all you've done is intellectually assent to Christian beliefs. And yet your life is no different. You haven't submitted yourself to God. You haven't conformed your life to his lordship. You say there is a God, but you're living as if there isn't. And the Kohelet says, don't allow yourself to live in this foolish contradiction because it's dishonest. It's a dishonest life. Either there is life above the sun, and this life is not all there is, that you have an eternal soul, and there is a God. There is a God who created you and sustains you, whom you will have to stand before one day and give an account. And therefore, there is meaning, and there is reason, and we need to find it, and we need to give ourselves to it. Either that's true, or there is no God. Life under the sun is all there is, and therefore, everything you do, everything you say, everything that you are living for right now is meaningless, 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 a chasing after the wind. And the book of Ecclesiastes just kind of leaves it there. Kind of leaves it there, just kind of hanging. I mean, it hints at the answer, but it doesn't give you the real answer that it's pointing to. And that's okay, because remember, the Kohelet's job isn't to give you answers, but it's to raise the question, is there a reason for your life? And the answer is not in the book of Ecclesiastes, it's in the book of John, chapter 1, verses 1 through 14. When John wrote his gospel, it was against the backdrop of this great debate within the Greek philosophical schools. The Greek philosophers would come together and they would argue about something called the logos. The logos, from which we get the word logic, was the ordering principle of life. It meant the reason for life. And they argued, what was the reason for life? What was the reason for life? If you came to my apartment and you saw me trying to make popcorn in my coffee maker, you would say, Kevin, let me tell you why your popcorn is of such poor quality. It's because you don't know the purpose. You don't know the reason. You don't know the logos of this machine. It's not built to make popcorn, Kevin. It's built to make coffee. And that's why when you try to make popcorn with your coffee maker, you not only make bad popcorn, but you're also ruining the machine. And the Greeks said, if you have something and you don't honor its logos, its reason for existence, its design, you will not only not reach its potential, but you will cause breakdown and disintegration and decay. But if you found the reason, if you found the logos of the object, it will reach its potential. It will experience wholeness and integrity and fulfillment and fullness. And so they asked, what if we found the logos for life? What if we found what we were created for and we conformed to that and we submitted to that and we honor that? Then we would reach our potential and we would experience wholeness. And so the schools went back and forth for a number of years arguing about the logos for life. But they couldn't agree. They said, what's the logos? What's the logos? Was it to live a good and moral life? What's the logos? Is it to reach the heights of wisdom and intelligence? What's the logos? And they pursued these logos, these theories down to the very end, and they found that it wasn't satisfying. It wasn't fulfilling, and they argued back and forth, what's the logos? And by the time Jesus came, the philosophical schools were in utter despair. They were hopeless. They had given up, and they started to say, you know what, there is no reason for life. There is no logos. And then John comes along, and he opens his gospel with, in the beginning was the logos, and the logos was with God, and he was God. And John says, to anyone who is looking for the answer to the question of life, he says, yes. Yes, absolutely, yes. There is a reason for living. But it's not a principle. It's not an abstract theorem. It's a person. The logos of life is a human being. He is God made flesh who came to earth to dwell among us. And when you know the logos of life, when you know Jesus, and you enter into a relationship with him, when you worship him and love him and serve him and give yourself to him, you will find your reason for living. When Jesus becomes your logos, your life gets shot through with meaning and glory. Everything has meaning now. Everything has meaning, from changing diapers to writing poems to going on walks, having conversations to going to work. Everything has meaning because it's connected to the eternal story of God. And that's the answer to Kohelet's question. Everything is meaningful, because in the Logos, you have purpose. You have a destiny, you have a telos, you have hope, and you have a reason to live. In the beginning was the reason for life, and he was with God, and he was God. And that reason for life became a human being, and he dwelled among us. We beheld his glory, the glory of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. Let's pray. Father, as we sit here in this holy moment, in the reality of your presence, God, I pray that right now you would speak to our hearts and give us a sense of the incredible hope that we have in you. Because our souls are eternal, and it was made for you. It was designed for you. And that when we have a relationship with you, we find our meaning, we find our reason, we find our purpose and our destiny and our reason for life. And we thank you in Jesus' name.